work sideways here. Okay, today is March 27th, 2019. This is an interview with Margaret Mooney. We are doing this interview at the Academic Staff Institute as part of our Academic Staff Award Winners Oral History Project. My name is Troy Reeves with the UW-Madison Oral History Program. So Margaret, as I said before I turned this on, if you could, for sound quality purposes, if you could say your name and spell your last name.
Margaret Mooney, M-O-O-N-E-Y.
Okay. Margaret, I'm just going to slide this a little closer to you. You'll be fine. I just may now need to project a little bit to make sure my questions get recorded. So, Margaret, thank you for giving me some of your time today. I gave you a list of questions in advance, and we'll just start with the top question, which is, you know, what brought you to UW-Madison?
Well, I came to Madison itself to work for the National Weather Service. We had a weather service office at the airport. I was the first woman to work there. It was a 24/7 job. It was meteorology, obviously. And that office closed in 1996, and they kept a liaison around, and I was that person. And they said, find a place for your office, you know, and they suggested maybe the emergency government folks downtown. Well, I knew right away I wanted to be on campus. You know, I knew the meteorology department was here, so I came and asked, and Pao Wang was the AOS chair at the time, and he said, sure, you can have an office. So they gave the Weather Service an office for free rent, and I got to work in that building, the Atmospheric, Oceanic, and Space Science building, but for the Weather Service for a couple of years, and it really gave me a good chance to meet everyone there. Eventually, that liaison position ended, and the Space Science and Engineering Center, which is in AOSS, gave me a 50% job. And part of the reason it was 50% was because I was going to the La Follette Institute at the time, getting a master's in public policy. So I think that they said, you know, do you want to work here? And I just said, not full time. And, you know, so that's how I started working over there.
Okay. So, Margaret, what encouraged you or enticed you to get that master's degree at La Follette?
Well, when I got my bachelor's years ago, that was the level of education that people got. And so I noticed that a lot of the jobs that I was interested in the Weather Service, or just people's jobs that I admired, they had a master's of public policy. So I thought I'd go do it. We had a great place to do that here at Madison, and I was interested in it.
Thank you. So backing up a bit, I guess it's really the next question, sort of the follow-up. So what factors led to your interest in meteorology and eventually to, you know, trying to pursue that as a profession?
I think it's more an interest in science. I started out pre-med in Ann Arbor. My dad was a doctor, my mom was a nurse, and I thought, oh, I'll just go ahead and be a doctor. And then I got a job working at Mott's Children's Hospital, where I was a ward clerk. You admit and discharge people. And in the very same day, I admitted and discharged a three-year-old named Betsy Clark, and because she died. And when I was doing the discharge paper, I realized I'm not going into medicine. What was I thinking? So at the time, I was taking a geology class, geology of the national parks, that I absolutely loved. So I instantly changed my major. One of the requirements to get a geology degree at the U of M was a 6-week field camp? Anyway, it was a field camp out in Wyoming. I mean, rocks, they don't bleed, they don't die. I had to be outside. I love geology. So actually I started in, well, you could say I started pre-med, but that wasn't very well informed. So then I went into geology, but when you graduated with the BS back then, the two jobs were taking oil out or putting nuclear waste in, and I wasn't interested in either of those. So I wrote to NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, and I applied to every division they had. So I actually got accepted into two, and I started out in the NOAA Corps. So those are uniformed officers that drive ships around the nation, the shores, and their motto is science and service. So they might be doing counting porpoises, they might be, you know, any scientific research that involves the shores around the United States. So I went to officers training out in Long Island, And while I was there, the Weather Service called and said, we have this job for you in Madison, Wisconsin. So I guess you can guess what I did. I went to Madison.
Mm-hmm. And just for my own curiosity, where was the camp in Wyoming?
Camp Davis. It's just south of the Tetons. It's beautiful.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I grew up in East Idaho, so I could see, on clear days, I could see the, what would that be, the west side of the Tetons from.
Nice.
Yeah. Yeah, not a bad part of the world to be from. All right, so when asked, I assume you're asked, when asked what you do, how do you describe currently what you do?
My day starts with the day-night band. This is how you know I'm a science geek. So what that is that's a sensor on a satellite. It's the only one that can detect the aurora borealis. And it's flown on polar orbiting satellites. So the type of satellites that go pole to pole while the Earth spins below them. Mm-hmm. There's two types of satellites. One is geostationary that follows the Earth, and the polar orbiter goes pole to pole. So it only gets snapshots, right? Because the Earth is always moving below it, and it's always going around in the north to south. And it is a joy to me to see whether the aurora borealis was captured, what it looked like, how vibrant it was. I just really enjoy looking at these images in the morning. And then if they're good ones, I share them on social media. For SIMS, I work for the Cooperative Institute for Meteorological Satellite Studies. That's also a NOAA institute. So I have this nice... I'm fortunate to work for NOAA for both my major careers. So anyways, that's before I'm even, out the door. Mm-hmm. I usually start that in the dark because I'm a morning early riser. And then when I get to the office, it depends on what's going on that week. But where I work, everything is soft money. So you have to write a proposal to get funding to work on something you want to work on. So there's often a lot of writing in my work, either to write proposals or to write reports about how the project has been successful. Mm-hmm. And there's often webinars, telecoms, meetings, planning meetings, because we're either putting on an event or planning an event. Right now we're planning for the SIMS High School Student Workshop. It's been going on since 1991. It's a STEM science camp where high school students come to the UW and stay in dorms and kind of learn about college life and then learn a lot about earth science. But we're just now starting to plan for that again. That'll be in June.
So to back up again just a little bit, because I know this job, your current job, is like about 7 years now. So how did your current job come about? How did you end up where you are now?
So being the director of education outreach at mm-hmm. SIMS, I am the first director. And I think it came about because I was starting to do a pretty good job, which sounds like bragging, but I have to tell you, in some ways, it's the easiest job in the world. So my job is to promote satellite remote sensing from the birthplace of satellite meteorology. I mean, how easy can that be? I sometimes liken it to being a chef or a cook and walking into a fully stocked kitchen with every utensil possible, and, really, how could you screw up? So there's so much exciting satellite-related research going on in my building that all I have to do is promote it. I don't have to think of the things myself. Sometimes I do, but I just work with a lot of talented colleagues, and because most of my colleagues, not most, but plenty of them have PhDs, and they're doing pretty hardcore research. But I understand enough of what they're doing and to translate it to the general public. I'm in a good middle ground for that.
So you talked a little bit about social media. Excuse me. So it sort of ties into a question about how technology has changed your work. You don't need to necessarily focus on social media, but the idea of, you know, you started really back in the, you know, late 80s, and now it's the late teens. What types of technology have arose, and how have they affected the work that you've done or tried to do?
Well, the funniest thing, I think, and I wish I would have kept one of those big discs. They look, you know, like a really huge pizza. At the National Weather Service, we used to take these discs in and out of the computer every day to store the data. Mm-hmm. Now, let's say that was, you know, 36 by 36 diameter inches. You know, anybody's cell phone can carry more data than that. So some of those things are pretty funny. We had one desktop at the Weather Service. But I think I'll just stick with satellite meteorology, because when I was working at the Weather Service, we used to get one image an hour, one satellite image an hour, one still one. Now we can get, anyone can get on the internet, so many images from so many satellites all the time. And in the very recent years, we've had two polar orbiting satellites that have gone up, the SUMI NPP and the NOAA 20, with just incredibly advanced technology. And also we have our newest weather satellites, the GOES-16 on the East Coast and the GOES-17 on the West Coast, and they're operational weather satellites. They are replacing weather satellites that our nation has had, where those satellites were able to measure 5 bands of the electromagnetic spectrum, and the new ones can measure 16. That's an incredible advancement. Mm-hmm. So once again, well, I guess you might have been partly trying to get with how does it make what I do at my work easier, but there's so much going on in technology that it makes my work easier, because there's so much to share and promote. Mm-hmm. So satellite technology has been advancing incredibly.
Is there ever a problem of having too much information to try to promote?
I wouldn't say to promote, but sometimes it's hard to explain it all. Because you have to figure out how to titrate it, I think, so that you don't overwhelm somebody, or that I actually can explain as far as they are asking, you know.
So the blurb online about you that highlights the fact that you won the Heidemann Award was talked about the fact that you were able to actually see these satellites, or at least some of these satellites, get launched.
Yeah, we did get to go to the launches.
As someone who's never got to see that, at least not up close and personal, what are your feelings about being there when things are launched up into space?
I thought it was absolutely amazing. So I also want to say that the reason why we got to do that is because I wrote the proposal to do it. So once again, if you have an idea and you can figure out how to convince funders to fund it, and all I said is, let's get some educators down there for the launch, you know. So I got to go too. But what I especially felt was an extreme sense of national pride. So when you go to a launch, first of all, you're at Kennedy Space Center, and you walk in, and there's John F. Kennedy. You know, I feel inspired right there. And, of course, there's all the rockets and, the ones that are just kept there, sort of like a theme park almost, but they're just, you can just see the rockets. And before a launch, they have these briefings, and you go into the auditorium, and they had 4 people there from NASA and NOAA on the stage, and the first thing they do is sing the national anthem. Mm-hmm. So we all stand up. You know, you really get a sense for, like, what a big deal it is. And then the 4 people gave us all a little bit of a briefing, and they answered some questions. I mean, that whole thing maybe took about a half hour. So you walk out pretty amazed. And then you go to the actual launch. To go to the actual launch, you get bussed out to better locations, closer to where the satellite's going to get launched. And the first thing they do is the national anthem. again. And I just think it's so cool that we do that. And we're everyone's on bleachers. And I think this is a pretty funny thing. They had Budweiser beer on ice that you could buy. So it's like, it was the most tastiest beer I've ever had. Because it was hot. We were in Florida. Mm-hmm. Not hot. It was warm. Mm-hmm. And everyone's just so excited and nice and excited about what's going to happen. And then eventually, for GOES 16, that was the first one that I saw, there's a launch window of about an hour. GOES 16 got pushed every 10 minutes into the next 10 minutes, into the next 10 minutes, the next 10 minutes, and finally launched in the last window. So you know, you can't make this stuff up. Mm-hmm. It was so exciting, and it finally launched. And it's been entirely successful ever since.
I think you described what tasks comprise a typical day when you talked about, you described what you do, but is there anything else about it that you do during a typical day that you
feel... should keep in it? Well, we frequently, but not every week or every day, but we frequently host visitors from schools to our building. So we're sharing satellite remote sensing. We like people to come to us. We don't really have the time to go out. And we also like to share what we have in our building. So especially in the spring, starting pretty soon, we'll have a lot of school groups come to our building. And so we do tours. We have a 3D globe, so we show weather on a sphere. Mm-hmm. I co-wrote that proposal also. And then we take them to the roof, of course. Everyone loves going to the roof of our building.
That's great. So I have going to shift gears, and I might ask, depending on how long this goes, I might come up and ask some more questions about your work, but I want to talk about academic staff stuff.
Okay.
So the first question on that is, were you or have you ever been involved in academic staff governance or committees?
I served as the alternate rep for CASI for several years, and so I went to a couple meetings when our rep, Denny Heckel, who's done it for lots of years, when he couldn't go, and then sometimes I just talked to him about it. And so that's how I found out that the UW is going to have an ad hoc committee on fossil fuel use and climate change. And I'll say I finagled my way onto it, because when I first heard about it, I heard that there were going to be academic staff people on it. And then they went ahead and formed with all just faculty. So I kind of complained a little bit to Denny. I'm like, hey, what happened? And so he, I don't know exactly what he did, but they're like, sure, she can join. And they let me join. And I learned a lot and really, really appreciated that opportunity.
And how long ago was that?
Almost 5 years now. It didn't turn out the way I wanted, but I learned a lot. We did not. I was hoping that we would get the university to divest from fossil fuels. And the vote from the committee was undecided or something like that. That wasn't, you know, it was mixed.
Mm-hmm. And it was just a committee that came together, discussed, and then, like, the committee had a shelf life.
Yeah, and had a report.
Okay.
Yeah. I actually got to write the summary on the report. Well, there were different chapters. I was very busy and involved, but we didn't get the university to divest from fossil fuels. I did, however, meet Bruce Barrett at that. He was on the committee. He's a faculty at Department of Family Medicine, and I have since been working with him on other projects, so that's been super nice for me.
Do you have a for example of another project that you worked on?
I have two examples. One is that shortly after that committee ended, the university had something called Climate Quest. So it was a competition to try to propose solutions to climate change and to mitigate climate change. And so we went ahead and entered one. It was Bruce's idea. It's called Mindful Climate Action. It's where you combined education on climate change with mindfulness meditation to reduce carbon footprint. Pretty exciting, I mm-hmm. think. We're currently waiting to hear on UW 2020 on that. So.
And I believe you, at least there's a person on that team, Kathy Middlecamp.
Yep.
Who we've also interviewed for this project.
Great. Did she bring it up too?
I think this was, I interviewed her pre.
Oh,
pre
I see.
That.
Okay.
Did you give both examples there? I'm sorry, I was taking notes. You said there were two examples where you've now worked on.
Yeah, it was the Climate Quest and Mindful Climate Action.
All right, so Climate Quest and the Mindful Climate. Got it. Thank you.
And since you bring up Kathy Middlecamp, I've known her through some NSF. I just think maybe she was at NSF meetings, and we both realized we were from UW-Madison. But a while ago, Steve Ackerman and I did an online MOOC, Massive Open Online Course, and it was on the changing weather and climate of the Great Lakes region. And I had Kathy Middlecamp do some of the videos. She was our expert on food and sustainability.
Can you talk a little bit more about the MOOC? Basically, you know, how you found out about it and then how you became, how you came to lead one.
I turned it off.
Reminds me I should check mine.
I thought I already did that. So the university announced the MOOCs about, I guess that's almost 5 years ago. Now, and Steve Ackerman, who was the director of SIMS for 20 years, and he's also a friend of mine, but Steve Ackerman came to my office. He said, come on, we should do this, you know. And they weren't offering very much money to do it. I only mention that because we certainly went in the red on our project. But they wanted us to do 4-week MOOCs, and so Steve was very smart in saying, oh yeah, spring, summer, winter, fall, that's easy, we can do that, you know. And so that was perfect. And he also had been wanting for a while to do a project working with libraries. So our MOOC was different. Our content, he and I were both very familiar with. It's just very timely to get it in that polished video form. But we also held weekly discussion groups at libraries around Wisconsin. I think we had 24. It was like the busiest 2 months of my whole career. But it was so rewarding. We just loved it. My favorite one was going up north. I had Eagle River and what was the other town? I mean, it was a long drive, but it was super rewarding. People appreciated the university going to them. They said, you know, usually we have to go down to Madison if we want to do something. It's so great that you guys are coming here.
And how do you think the MOOC went?
I know, well, there were evaluations done, and I know that I've had follow-up emails with people. I think ours was one of the best ones because of those library discussions. We found that more people finished our MOOC than the other ones. We also asked everybody to change one habit each week to lighten their carbon footprint. And we found that a majority of people, well, practically everybody in the discussion groups did it, but a large majority of people did, you know, take that on. Whether they did it for longer than the month, I don't know. Because that's one of the reasons I am interested in that ad hoc committee, Mindful Climate Action, the MOOC, is trying to get people to change their habits a little bit.
And I know your personal statement in the 2-page resume that you gave me talks about this, but I wonder if you would talk about why this this topic is of such importance to you.
Well, the topic being how could we slow or reverse climate change, it's important to me largely because of my children, I'd have to say. I know that there are changes going on right now, but I don't feel that I am personally hurt too much by climate change here in Wisconsin. I mean, our basement is flooded. I don't call that a worry. Relative to what so many people are experiencing elsewhere in the world. I hear Louisiana's losing a football field of land daily from rising sea level. But I think the next generation, I mean, let's face it, the planet's going to be fine. It's people that are living on planet. They're going to be challenged by really terrible consequences of climate change, whether it's air quality problems, whether it's sea level rise. But I would really like to see our planet habitable for future generations.
Okay.
I want it to be known that I tried to make a difference. I want my kids to know that I tried, that I didn't just, you know, make things worse.
Mm-hmm.
They're young adults now. They're not kids, but...
So, then just to get back to, again, a couple more questions about academic staff. The next is, do you ever think about the relationship between faculty and staff? And if so, what are your thoughts on that?
I don't think about it as much as others on campus might, and that's probably because SIMS and SSEC, where I work, doesn't have any faculty. The SIMS director has to be AOS faculty. So Steve Ackerman was always professor in AOS, and we just now have a new director, and he is also faculty, but practically no one else at SIMS is faculty. We're all just, you know, masters and PhDs doing research, writing grants, and doing outreach. But I have to say that the faculty that I do know quite well, which would be Steve and other AOS professors, are just super nice people. I enjoy working in the same building with them. And then my other examples would be Kathy Middlecamp and Bruce Barrett, and they are really wonderful to work with too. So I think people are just people.
Okay. So would you mind talking about the story behind getting the Heidemann Award?
I'd love to. First, I'd like to thank Robert and Carol Heidemann for even supporting the award. I think it's super generous. It really is fun for people in my position to get that award. I mean, it's kind of like a whole year, an exciting full year. My colleagues did tell me that they were putting me up for it because they added a little portfolio of pictures. You know, you can add extra stuff, and they asked me to gather them for them. But they did the rest of the work, and they found the letters, and, you know, I asked, so who'd you ask? And they really asked the perfect people, I thought. Like a good representation, both people in Madison and people elsewhere in the country. And it was just super exciting. One morning, Steve Ackerman and Gene Phillips, the two people who promoted me, came into my office together, and I just thought, you know, I was curious the way they walked in. I thought, I'm either in trouble or this is good. I don't know what's going on. And they said, congratulations. It was just super exciting. The other thing is, I'd like to point out, I think this is interesting, my partner, Meg Gaines, got that same award about 20 years ago. And In 2015, when it became legal for same-sex couples to get married, we became married. So I think this is the first time, probably, on campus where both spouses have received the same Academic Excellence Award. Just a little fun fact.
Do you have thoughts about the reception?
It was super fun. They had fancy hors d'oeuvres, they had alcohol, I had one glass of wine just to make sure I could do my little speech. And I got to sit with Carol Heidemann, I thought that was nice. And I had an opportunity, well, what was very cool for me too, actually, is that Chancellor Blank used to be the head of Department of Commerce, which is in charge of our nation's satellites. So I got to thank her as I went up and say what an honor it is to get this award from you, of all people, since my award was largely related to working in outreach with satellite remote sensing. So that was super fun. And that was fun to be able to thank my colleagues and acknowledge what a great place it is to work here. And I mentioned already a little bit about that, the fact that Madison is the birthplace of satellite meteorology. I included that in my little thank you speech. And when I said it, someone in the room laughed. And I thought, and I, you know, of course, I wasn't making a joke. And I realized that's how little people even know this bit of information. I think it's a huge story. It's a huge, it's super unique. And clearly there's a lot of work to be done along those lines when people on campus don't even know that we're the birthplace of satellite meteorology. Mm-hmm. So.
Margaret, before we get into I think you've talked a little bit about that last question, the legacy question, but before we get into that, is there other things you either have on your notes or other things about your job or jobs here that you want to touch on?
The only thing I have on my notes that I haven't mentioned is I did say my day starts with the day-night band. It does. I'm enchanted by it. And then I share it on social media. And once, a couple years ago, I combined some pictures of the Northern Lights that someone had shared on Twitter and with a day-night band image. And it turned out to be quite popular. So the person, his name is Where's Jeff, he's from Alberta, Canada, said, "That is so cool. I've always wanted to see the images, the satellite images, combined with pictures from below." So we started a citizen science project doing just that. Mm. It's brand new, and that is also an exciting part of my job.
What was that called again? Sorry.
We're calling it, it's acronyms. The VIRS Aurora SATCAM project. And VIRS is the name of the instrument that is able to detect the aurora.
Okay. So, Margaret, and I think you've touched on this again, as I said, but the last questions are questions of legacy. And I try to ask this in a way of, you know, what you think you'll be remembered for, and is it what you want to be remembered for?
Here's what I think I'm going to be remembered for, and I'm going to share it with you via one of my favorite stories. So it was Halloween, and I go to the door, and I'm passing out candy, and this youngster looks up, and he says, "You're Margaret Mooney!" And my niece was there, and she was really impressed that this kid said that to me and knew who I was. And I said, "Yes." And he said, "I came to your building. We went to the roof." I said, "Oh, right. I didn't recognize you because of your costume." But anyways, I do go places sometimes where someone says, "Oh, yeah, you took my Girl Scout troop, you know, to the roof," or, you know, "You shared that science on a sphere with my group." So I think some people are going to remember me as someone who taught them a little bit about weather or climate, and they're not going to remember my name, or they might if they're there like that guy, my trick-or-treater. And how I'd like to be remembered by my colleagues, so just in my building, I have tried, or it's important to me, and I have tried to kind of get the groups to work together. For instance, Science Expedition. We have an open house, and I try to get everyone to participate, and they do. So I feel like because we're in this, you know, stacked building, 16-story building, it's hard for us. We don't just run into each other the way other people might. So I've tried to think of things. We have a building-wide Instagram account that I started, where I just asked representatives from every group, you know, do you want to do this? Can we do this? So I hope I'm remembered a little bit that way. And then in the big picture, I hope I'm remembered as someone who made a bit of a difference addressing climate change. I like Obama's quote where he said, "We are the first generation to feel the effect of climate change and the last generation who can do something about it." I do think we're in an important time in history where we have a chance to make a big difference, but it needs to be, you know, soon.
Margaret, is there anything else you want to say?
Thanks for interviewing me today.
Well, Margaret, thank you. So this concludes the oral history with Margaret Mooney. Thanks again for your time.
Thanks, Troy.
So...